800 acres. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, presenting an in-depth look at the digital generation at edutopia.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Support for today's programs comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Saturday from 2 to 6. Information is available at 337-7704 or at thecorkscrew.com.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, 90.9 FM HD2, online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. When kids are learning a new game, they appreciate the chance for a do-over. Our guest this afternoon wondered, if kids can ask for a do-over, why not, as an adult, revisit the ups and downs of childhood? Robin Hemley is our guest. Among the things Robin Hemley did over, he goes back to kindergarten, reprises a second-grade role in The Littlest Angel, does a do-over recalling one really tough year in his life, in many lives, I suspect, the eighth grade, and he finds a date for the high school prom. Robin Hemley tells these stories and more in his book, Do-Over, in which a 48-year-old father of three returns to kindergarten, summer camp, the prom, and other embarrassments. As Hemley is in the midst of these do-overs, his life as a 48-year-old father and husband continues. And here, in the juxtaposition of then and now, is where we find the struggle and the sweetness of life. Listeners, looking back across the years today, what would you revisit? Why? What opportunity does the process of recalling and reflecting on our long-ago experiences offer us? I look forward to hearing your answers to those questions, and I look forward to your questions for our guest, Robin Hemley, now a father of four daughters. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Robin Hemley is the director of the nonfiction writing program at the University of Iowa, Do-Over, in which a 48-year-old father of three returns to kindergarten, summer camp, the prom, and other embarrassments, is published by Little Brown. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. More about our guest, by the way, and his book, Do-Over, online at robinhemley.com. Robin Hemley, good to talk with you. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm fine. How's the family?
Very good. Just got back from a road trip, and we're all a little tired, but we had a good time.
Yeah. What did your wife Margie and your daughters Olivia, Isabella, and Sochi think of this project, this do-over project?
Well, you know, they're different ages, so they thought very different things. My eldest, you know, is and was a teenager when I started the project in 2006. And like any good teenager, she was properly mortified by the idea of, you know, her dad making a fool out of himself and was always advising me on how not to make a fool out of myself, while my 12-year-old daughter, Isabel, was gung-ho and wanted me to make a fool out of myself. And my 6-year-old, well, she was 3 at the time, Shoshi, just, you know, was along for the ride and enjoyed it.
Yeah. You say this project wasn't so much about doing something over so as to get it right, but to examine roadblocks. What do you mean?
Well, you know, obviously we can't change the past, but we can change the way we think about the past. And, you know, as Socrates famously said, the unexamined life is not worth living. And I, as a memoir writer, I firmly believe this, but I thought it would be fun to, you know, go back and examine the fender benders of my childhood and see not only how they had made me who I am today, but the misconceptions I had about those fender benders and what, not what I would necessarily change, but how I might regard them now with an adult perspective.
Yeah. Now, when you began to think of looking back at the fender benders and to examine what had happened, were you at a point where you needed to do that, where you were as an adult, a husband, a father?
Well, you know, I wouldn't characterize it as a midlife crisis exactly, because, you know, I feel like I've been having midlife crises, you know, once a year since I was 25, so that's nothing new for me. No, I really just the idea came to me one day, really first to go back to summer camp. That was the first one. And once I did the summer camp episode, it was so much fun and so enlightening for me that I thought, you know, I could easily do 10 of these, and I was able to write my list in about 5 minutes. But I wouldn't say there was an actual sort of moment in my life, that some crisis in my life that I'd come to, except just the normal sort of everyday, you know, crisis of living, of getting up and doing the next thing.
Yeah. Why did you want to go back to summer camp?
Well, summer camp, I had had sort of mixed experiences, both as a camper and a counselor. And, you know, I was kind of a miserable physical specimen. I like sports now, but I didn't then. And, you know, I thought it would be fun to actually go back and be the camp hero and you know, be good at baseball and basketball and all that thing, that kind of thing, and actually be able to beat 10-year-olds. But I found out that, no, I was still really bad at basketball, and they could still beat me at all these games. And, I found out, of course, it didn't matter so much anymore. I enjoyed, you know, the company and enjoyed the sort of, you know, the camaraderie of camp that I had missed, really, the first time.
Hmm. You were then older than the counselors when you returned to do this. So how did that work out?
Well, you know, it's funny. You know, when someone tells you that someone is coming back as a camper, it doesn't matter how old you are, because the counselors, even if they're 18 years old, treat you as one of their charges. So they completely treat, you know, I think they reveled in the idea that they got to boss around an adult like a camper, you know. So, you know, if I wanted to go get aspirin in my bunk, I had to be escorted there by, you know, a 16-year-old counselor in training, because, you know, I wasn't allowed to have meds like any camper. And, you know, so they loved the idea of me being sort of one of their charges.
Yeah. All along the way, you found friends wherever you went. You made friends. What kind of experiences did you have with the campers in this do-over?
Well, you know, mostly throughout all the do-overs, I was surprised that both adults and kids completely accepted me, with a few exceptions. Now, the camp I went to is called Camp Echo in upstate New York. Hello?
Yeah, we're still here.
Oh, sorry. I had some kind of glitch there. So anyway.
We got another glitch.
Yeah.
Okay.
The camp I went there, went to Camp Echo. It was, there were 350 campers there, and not all of them knew about my project. So at one point, a bunch of eighth graders surrounded me and, you know, said, "You're bunking with the fifth graders? You know, did you, you know, flunk fifth grade 1,000 times?" So they were a little surprised by it. But for the most part, the campers, you know, they all believed that, you know, if they were my age or even a little older, they'd want to go back and maybe do over some things too, because, you know, regret is just a part of every life, I think, even young kids.
Yeah. What kind of regrets did they tell you about, or did they?
Well, they didn't confide in me so much in that way, but they did, you know, they all sort of got the project right away. You know, when I did the Littlest Angel project, it was funny because in that case, I had flubbed a line when I was 7 years old. I was the heavenly messenger, and I was supposed to deliver a box of heavenly goods to the littlest angel. And I got out on stage and froze. And instead of delivering my line, I just threw the box at the kid and said, "Here's your stupid box," and ran off stage. And I found this group in Marietta, Georgia, putting on the Littlest Angel again, and they let me reprise my role. And the kids in the cast all said to me, you know, if I did that, I'd want to do the same thing. Mm. I'd want to go back and try it again.
Yeah. When you were talking with folks outside the situations that you were in doing the do-overs, how did people react to what you were about when you said, "Well, I'm doing this"? Did anyone suggest, "Hey, you know, why not just move on"?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the thing is that it was done with a kind of lighthearted spirit. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it was done in a humorous fashion. You know, I've always been a fan of films like Billy Madison or Big with Tom Hanks, or you know, those films in which adults go back and you know, are kids again. Freaky Friday, it's a whole Hollywood tradition, but as far as I knew, no one had actually done anything like it for real. So, you know, in that spirit, I wanted to go back and do these things, not because I hadn't, you know, moved on with my life. I mean, I certainly had. And in that spirit, I think people understood it and were all, you know, supportive of it. Of course, you know, when you say, you know, you're 48 years old and you want to go back to kindergarten or summer camp or any of these things, you know, they don't just say, "Okay, come on in." Mm-hmm. They, you know, you have to go through background checks and all of those things that, of course, I'd be concerned if they didn't require those things.
Yeah. So how was the Littlest Angel the second time around?
Well, I didn't blow my line, and it was a little nerve-wracking because somehow my memory had changed the whole production. I thought that I only had one line in this production, but in fact, somehow the new production, I had 13 lines, and it had changed into a musical. So I had to now memorize all these musical numbers as well. And so it became like one of those nightmares where where things become much worse than you ever expected them to be. Like, you show up in for a test for a class that you didn't even know you had. That kind of nightmare. But somehow I muddled through, and I didn't get a standing ovation, but I did get an ovation.
Yeah. You know, when we try to retrace our steps in life, it can be tricky, to say the least. Memory has its tricks. How did you take that into account?
Well, I do understand that, you know, the way you remember something is not necessarily the way it really happened, because once an experience is gone, it's gone. And we all know that, you know, when I remember something or when you remember something and you, it's an event that maybe someone else in your family went through as well, you compare notes and they're completely different.
Mm-hmm.
So I took that into account. And in fact, part of the project was about that, about how my memories had actually changed the past, because I did find that some of the things that I had built up in my mind as, you know, real flubs or, you know, real traumas or whatever, or real failures, other people didn't remember them that way. And so in that way, it was really enlightening and,
yeah,
you know, in some way healing too.
Sure. In the end of the kindergarten experience, you say, in most ways it turns out I'm the same as a 48-year-old kindergartner as I was a 5-year-old kindergartner. Is that pretty much what happened to you throughout the experience?
Well, I mean, I did find... I don't really like the term inner child because it's too much a pop psychology term, but I do think that in some ways I have one, and we all have at least access to, ourselves as kids and those memories. And I did find that... I enjoyed doing the same things that, you know, I enjoyed when I was 5. I enjoyed recess, for instance. I thought, wow, what a wonderful idea, recess. I'd forgotten about recess, how much fun that was. Now I think, you know, everyone should have recess, you know, adults and children alike. But, you know, I did find that in all my do-overs that, you know, when I was in eighth grade or in high school or whatever, that those memories of who I was when I was that age came flooding back very easily. And so there was, while I've moved on in many ways, and certainly hopefully have matured in a lot of ways, I still recognize the person I was at that particular age.
Yeah. So now the roadblocks today, have they been cleared away?
Yeah, I would say. I mean, I don't have any need to go back and do a, you know, sequel or do-over two under the planet of do-overs or anything like that. I really enjoyed what I did, and, you know, now I'm, you know, hopefully moving on to a new project. But I always like to do new things in my writing. I like to challenge myself as a writer. And so all my books are very different from one another. And this book, when it presented itself, it started with an article that I did for New York Magazine, and when I realized that this was something that I could really explore more fully in a book, I thought, okay, well, I'm going to do this. I've never done anything like it. It's quite there. It's going to be embarrassing and hard and fun, and it was. It was all that. But I think I'm done with that now.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, writer Robin Hemley. His latest book is Do Over, in which a 48-year-old father of three returns to kindergarten, summer camp, the prom, and other embarrassments. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. I look forward to your phone calls, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Robin Hemley's previous books include Turning Life into Fiction, Nola, a memoir of faith, art, and madness, and Invented Eden, the elusive, disputed history of the Tacidae. His latest book, Do Over, is published by Little Brown. You'll find more about our guest and his book, Do Over, online at robinhemley.com. Tell us about a couple of the experiences you had when you returned to kindergarten.
Well, I had said that the kids all accepted me pretty well, and it's true. I knew this on the first day when I was waiting to be dismissed with the other kids. We were sitting in a circle, and one of the kids asked me, so who's picking you up after school? And I said, my wife. And they all were amazed by that, because they expected something else. They, kindergartners don't have wives. And so one of them said, oh, I thought you were going to say your dad. So I was really surprised by their reactions to me, because when I first went into kindergarten, the teacher and the teacher's assistant and the principal all thought that they would treat me like just an adult observer. But since they had been told I was a kindergartner, I had a bad experience the first time and was coming back for a good experience, they accepted that. In one case, I remember one of the kids went back reportedly to his parents and said to them, you know, there's a really tall, big kindergartner in class now, and I don't really know what to think of him. And so, you know, I baffled them a little bit, but for the most part, they thought it was... you know, they accepted me.
Yeah. You had a couple of good buddies, Lewis, Stefan, and Abdul.
Yes.
They took you right in and welcomed you. What was that like?
Well, I was shown the kindergarten ropes, you know, by these three. They sort of treated me like the most popular kid in class, and I was constantly it on the playground during recess, playing freeze tag and things like that. They showed me how to do my attendance cube and how to pick out lunch and, you know, if you wanted to go to the bathroom, what you did for that. So they were very serious and intent on all that. They also sort of competed for me, for my attention during playtime. I remember, I think it was, Stefan, who wanted me to do cooking with him in the cooking station. And I was, you know, since I'm also a professor and I teach, I was teaching a class on some controversial memoirs, and I was teaching the James Fry memoir, A Million Little Pieces, and I had that with me. I was reading it surreptitiously at nap time, and Stefan grabbed it and made it into our cookbook, which I well, okay, I'll dub that a Million Little Pizzas then.
Well, what's a day like in kindergarten today as compared with when you were in kindergarten as a five-year-old and you were in, your teacher was Mrs. Collins?
Well, I'll say, first of all, that kindergarten is a lot of hard work. I mean, you do one activity after another, and kindergartners just sort of spontaneously get up and start dancing and skipping, and there are about 10 activities in the first 2 hours, you know, so it's exhausting for a 48-year-old. But my original kindergarten teacher, Mrs. Collins, she actually was put in a mental institution the year after she had me as a student. And, you know, I wouldn't say I completely contributed to her breakdown, but I helped. There was an incident with a rubber lobster that got stuck in my report card. I'm not, still to this day, I don't know how it got stuck, but when she opened it to look for my mother's signature, the lobster popped out and kind of flew into her mouth, and she screamed and called my mother in for a conference and told her I was going to grow up to be a thug. And those were her exact words. So after that, she kind of declared war on me, and it was pretty crazy for the rest of the year. And I got some great stories out of it, but I think at the time it was probably pretty terrifying for me. So that one sort of leapt to mind immediately when I was thinking of do-overs. Mm-hmm. And the new one, of course, kindergarten now for me was a breeze, you know, except for the many activities. It was all play and fun, and I was, you know, certainly the most knowledgeable of the five-year-olds, or kindergartners, I should say.
Yeah. What's an alpha friend?
An alpha friend? Well, an alpha friend was a member of the alphabet. So Andy Apple, you had a different designated alpha friend each day, I think, in kindergarten, in the new kindergarten experience. And we had stories centering around Andy Apple and, you know, each day a new adventure. And so it was a way to learn the alphabet. So there's a lot of that goes on, unsurprisingly, in kindergarten.
Yeah, yeah. Also, there's some interesting rules. I've found myself trying to think back to my days in kindergarten. It's been a long time. And I don't recall the kinds of rules that were in Mrs. Statler's classroom for you in this do-over.
Yeah, well, the rules, there were rules posted everywhere. You know, when I was a kid, there were no rules. And, you know, childhood was something that, you know, you went off and did alone until you got over it. And people didn't really pay much attention to kids, unfortunately. Now there's a kind of hyper-awareness, of course. And so these rules or values were posted not only in kindergarten, but in camp and eighth grade and sixth grade and so on. And I found this as a real common denominator, almost a kind of childhood indoctrination. I mean, of course, the rules were valuable ones. In kindergarten, they were called the I care rules, and they went, we listen to each other, hands are for helping, not hurting, we use I care language, we care about each other's feelings, we are responsible for what we say and do, and the most important, different is great.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, this was a constant theme during the day, was always reinforced by the kindergarten teacher, different is great. And I was all for that. I mean, when I was a kid, different kind of got you beat up generally, or at least made you lose your lunch money.
Mm. Different is great. And another difference in your experience from when you were a five-year-old to when you were 48 is that the classroom is really diverse.
It is, wonderfully so. You know, and I was very, very happy to see that. You know, my wife is from the Philippines, and my child you know, is going into a classroom in which she, you know, she can feel comfortable now. And when I was growing up, I was the only Jewish kid most often in my classes, and you know, you didn't always feel comfortable as the different kid.
Yeah. Did that present a problem going back to your performance as a little boy in The Littlest Angel?
Not really. Yeah. You know, I didn't really have a problem with being in a Christian play. You know, it didn't. The first time I did it, it didn't make me instantaneously convert to Christianity. Mm-hmm. And the second time, I don't think I was in any there was any threat of that either. In fact, by coincidence, the kid playing the Littlest Angel and the Heavenly Messenger, the two kids, both happened to be Jewish in the new production as well. So I thought that was a great coincidence.
Robin Hemley, his latest book, Do-Over, in which a 48-year-old father of three returns to kindergarten, summer camp, the prom, and other embarrassments. Robin Hemley is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, if you've got a question, a comment, we'd love to hear from you. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, a lot harder than kindergarten is the sixth grade. And here you revisit a period in your life when, in the sixth grade, it was a pretty tough scene. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I was just bullied a bit in the sixth grade. It's not that uncommon for kids to go through that, but I wanted to go back this time to sort of conquer my notions of, you know, of being intimidated, or my memories of being intimidated, I should say. So the sixth grade was also just a year where I lost a couple of my best friends in accidents, and so it was a kind of dark year for me. And so I felt like I needed to go back and sort of you know, just recover a sense of what that would have been like without those sort of dark clouds.
Mm-hmm. Here, was it easy to fit in as a 48-year-old with sixth graders?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't that hard. I mean, it was surprising. Again, you know, the kids were really, they enjoyed the project, and they liked the idea of someone paying attention, an adult paying attention to who they were and what they were going through, the hoops they were going through on their way to adulthood. And so the kids didn't have much of a problem. I remember one art teacher in sixth grade, though, was really skeptical. And as soon as I walked into art class, she said, you know, I'm going to have a lot of trouble with this. And I understood that, you know, but I had been so, I was so used to, by that time, kids and adults really enjoying the idea of the project, really getting into it, that I was kind of taken aback by her sort of frontal assault right away as soon as I walked into the art class. But by the end of the art class, she was reminiscing about her sixth grade experience. And the teachers who had troubled her, or the teachers who had been nice. And it seemed like she was all of a sudden a kind of convert to the project, to the idea of examining these things. So I also got in trouble on the playground, I remember. During recess, all the kids wanted to, the kids who weren't playing football, and I was never much of a football player, they decided to play something they called Zombie Death Ray. So I became part of the crowd fighting off zombies, and you know, we were making our hands into different kinds of weapons. I think I can't remember what mine was, but we got in trouble with the woman known as the playground lady, who stormed up to us and told us no pretend weapons. And of course, at that moment, I thought, oh, of course, you know, that should have been evident to me. But there's something that I learned about in summer camp from the director of the summer camp that was a really valuable thing for me to learn about. It's called regressive pull. And it's the idea that an adult around a group of kids, instead of the kids acting like adults, the adult will tend to regress. And it's a very common thing. In fact, it's something they talk to their counselors about. And she said, you know, in most cases it's a negative thing, but in your case we're seeing its positive benefits. But regressive pull, in most of the do-overs, you know, had me in a kind of headlock, and I would have to kind of step back and say, okay, well, this was fun, but of course I'm an adult, and you would have to sort of have a part of you that was observing this and saying, okay, well, you know, of course I'm not in sixth grade, or of course I'm not, you know, a kindergartner. But every once in a while, you'd sort of slip into that role.
Yeah. In this episode in your book, you say 70 to 80% of the time you act your age in public, but at home that percentage plummets. So here we have an insight in terms of regressive pull, and then you have to pull back from that. Was that where that insight came from there?
Yeah, well, you know, I was thinking, I think, about how when you're with your family, especially the family in which you grew up, all of a sudden you revert very quickly to who you were when you were 10 years old. You know, you act with your parents sometimes, you know, or they react to you like as though you're 10 years old. And I think that sometimes in our families, our levels of maturity drop really precipitously and rapidly, depending on our history, you know, because we fall into these patterns, and the patterns, you know, the age at which they developed is sort of sometimes the age that we freeze at. So it's easy. I think regressive pull does affect us in a sort of everyday way sometimes.
Yeah. Well, at one point in the story here, you are being let off at school, and you and your wife had kind of had a little difficulty that morning, and she drops you off, and she says, "You walk home."
right. And, you know, so, yeah, we had a little fight, and it was like
Your mom dropping you off.
It was, and it was very creepy at that point. I had to sort of step back and say, okay, well, you know, obviously this could get really Freudian very quickly. So I need to pull back from this. So I, you know, that's why I put that moment in the book, because I thought it was pretty funny.
Yeah. What insights did you glean in the sixth grade about what sixth graders are like today?
Well, let me think about that. I think with sixth graders, I'd say with childhood in general, you know, it's very different from when I was a kid. I think for better, for the most part, worse a little bit. I think that, you know, the charge of hyper-parenting, or, you know, the helicopter pilot or the helicopter parent is, you know, an apt one, that sometimes our children are so taken care of that they don't get to experience the things that we did. I mean, the general idea is that things are more dangerous now than they were back then. But I think childhood has always been dangerous. But in any case, I think that the kids now, at least on the positive side, they are given more praise than they used than in my day. They can be overpraised, but at least they're given a kind of guidance in terms of also how they should treat other people, how they should, you know, respect themselves and other people. And really, in my day, that was completely left up to the parent, and sometimes parents didn't pay attention to that very well. And so, you know, for all those signs up on the wall, even though they seem sometimes like a training camp, they do have some value, I think. So the kids, by and large, tended to be a little more positive than when I was a kid.
Yeah, it seems also, at least in the particular case of the sixth grade teacher, she's pretty cool with Perry's being a smart aleck, and, you know, we'll just move on.
Yeah, that's true. There was this kid named Perry who, and of course I changed all the names in the book of the kids, but there's a kid who I call Perry, who is the bully of the classroom. And he was the kind of child who, you know, wants to get attention all the time and is constantly making jokes and trying to divert people's attention and so on. And she was very good at handling that. Mm-hmm. In my day, we had a kid named Lee Wanger who, when, you know, he was very much like Perry, except he was probably, most likely, ADD, except at that time, those things weren't diagnosed. And he was, not only was he always getting in trouble, but he always successfully distracted the teacher in the class and then was getting into more and more trouble, and it just snowballed into a terrible situation. So with a kid like Perry, I think teachers and counselors and so on are much more prepared to deal with all these situations now.
Yeah. Well, how did sixth grade how is sixth grade different from eighth grade?
Well, eighth grade, I think, as you mentioned in the lead-in, was probably the worst year for me, and I think it's a very difficult year for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Sixth grade, I had to deal with bullies. In eighth grade, I had to deal with bullies too, but I also just I had a lot of problems going on in my family in eighth grade, and so another big difference was that in the sixth grade that I went to, I wasn't able to go back to the original school that I'd been to, but in the eighth grade, I went back to the exact same school that I had been to in Columbia, Missouri. And so that was very strange for me because it was really like I'd stepped back into time. The principal of the school, in fact, was someone who had started out as a social studies teacher in the year that I started as a student at that school, Jefferson Junior High School. And eighth grade, I had been sort of threatened with the vice principal's paddle, and had, you know, was at a time of corporal punishment, and a lot of it was a really very violent school, and at the time, and now it had just completely turned around, and you know, had won awards as a model school, you know, in the country, and it was run in a very even-handed and judicious way by this homegrown principal.
Hmm. And how was the experience of coolness and uncoolness different first time around, second time around?
Oh, well, see, in eighth grade, when I went back to eighth grade, all of a sudden I was the cool kid because I was this adult going back. And the first day I was invited to have lunch with the cool kids at the table. I didn't know this until later at my locker. Girl who was at her locker said, "Hey, oh, I heard you got to sit with the cool kids at lunch." And I was really, again, sort of through regressive pull, I think I was overly excited about this. And I said, "Wow, really? I didn't know I got to sit with the cool kids." And when my wife Margie picked me up, I said almost first thing, "Guess what? I got to sit with the cool kids at lunch." And she said, well, then tomorrow, of course, you got to sit with the uncool kids. And so I did, and of course, won only the enmity of the cool kids after that. They wouldn't have anything to do with me for the rest of the week. But of course, the difference is that I didn't care anymore. You know, being an adult, I'd got grown up. But at the same time, those feelings were very close to the surface, those feelings of rejection and acceptance. I mean, they really do kind of shape us. And as much as we might not like to admit it, they're there, close to the surface.
Yeah. Well, tell us about prom.
Well, prom was really fun. Of course, the first time it wasn't, or I wouldn't have to do it over. But the first time, I went to a private boarding school. We moved around a lot when I was a kid, and I went to a school in Tennessee called St. Andrews. And it had about 150 boys and 30 girls. And there was this one young woman named Lizzie Clark, who I had a crush on. We were in the school play together. We were the two leads in the play Antigone. I was Creon and she was Antigone. And I had a big crush on her and wanted to ask her out to the prom but was too shy. So come prom night, I just sort of stared in the window forlornly, and that was basically my prom experience. So flash forward 30 years or so, and I called up the school to see if I could go back for a week and spend a week back at St. Andrews doing over my senior year. And they said, well, that sounds interesting. We'll have to check with the administration. But first of all, you should speak with our liaison for alumni, Lizzie Clark Duncan. And the name immediately rang a bell. And, you know, 2 seconds later, I was talking to my high school crush who had come back to Suwanee, Tennessee after many years' absence and had become the alumni liaison. Mm-hmm. And I said, so, Lizzie, you know, do you want to go to the prom with me? And she said, she said, well, but I'll have to check with my husband. And I said, yeah, I'll probably have to check with my wife. And so we went to the prom together, and I think I did a first in prom history in that the night of the prom, not only did I take Lizzie to dinner, but I took her husband and her 8-year-old son to dinner as well. And it was a lot of fun, and we had a great time. The students, again, were completely supportive, and, you know, there was no pressure. There was not going to be a kiss, and no pressure for that. And so it was just it was a lot of fun. We had a great time, and we renewed our friendship. And that was another one of the great things about these do-overs for me, is that I was able to renew friendships with people who I had thought were lost forever in the past, you know.
Yeah. Another thing that you did was you went back to a place where you had spent time growing up, a house.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That's interesting as well. I think it would be really interesting to do that, because the house where you lived when you're a child, it's so loaded with all kinds of things.
Yeah. Well, that do-over was logistically the most difficult, and I think for obvious reasons. I mean, people just would not necessarily want a stranger saying, hey, can I live in your house with you for a week or 3 days or 4 days or whatever. And so that was a very difficult one to do just logistically. Luckily, as I said, we moved around a lot, so I had a number of houses to choose from. And one of the owners of one of the houses understood the idea, got it, and after we talked and I agreed to make her anonymous, she said, sure, let's do it. So, and it turned out to be just the right house for me, because it was the house in which, as you say, houses are loaded, and in this case, it was the house that I was living in when my older sister, Nola, who I'd written a previous book about, when she died, I was living there. And so, and my mother had passed away in 2004. So going back there was, pretty moving experience. Add to that the owner, as it turned out, knew just in passing my mother's best friends, and she had not lived in that town for 10 years or so before her death. And so the owner of the house, without me prompting her in any way, decided to have a dinner party in which she invited all of or a number of my mother's old friends. And so we had this great gathering in this house that was pretty emotionally loaded. And so it was a quieter chapter, but I think a very important chapter for me to write.
Yeah. Near the end of the book, you have one more do-over to do, but at the same time, you and your family are looking forward to the birth of a girl who would be named Naomi Pearl. So you're at one hand, you've got one foot in the past and one foot in the future.
Right.
And one of the things you say at the end is all these experiences you think have made you a connoisseur of childhood. So now you've got these four girls, two of whom live with your ex-wife, and the two girls that live with you and Margie. What has this meant for you in terms of solidifying who you are as a family?
Well, that's a good question. I think that I've become a more, I think as a parent, I've become very much of a listener to my children, that I understand now sort of the things that they're going through, or if I don't understand them, I at least listen to what they're going through, because sometimes it's easy for us as parents to discount mm-hmm. the little bumps, you know, in our children's lives, but we don't know really what's going to stick with them and what's the fact that it is important to them then should be important to us. And I think that's something that's really hit home for me in doing this project. I hope it's made me a better parent more attuned to my children in the everyday, of their lives. And paying attention to each little hoop that they have to jump through.
Yeah, the ups and downs.
Yep.
For those of us who can't go back to kindergarten, literally, and do all these kinds of things, it seems to me that it might be a very good idea for us to sit down and maybe write something or meditate on a particular instance, go back in our memory and think about it, and then come forward.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on what we might do to accomplish that?
Well, I mean, I think that that's what we do, or what I do as a writer all the time, is the whole notion of almost a kind of self-hypnosis of going back in time and writing about a particular incident. And then, the whole impulse to share that is, the writerly impulse. It's true that most people won't have a chance to actually go back and physically occupy their past, but to do so mentally and emotionally is still very powerful and I think important.
Robin Hemley, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. I had a very good time. Thanks.
Robin Hemley is the author most recently of Do-Over, in which a 48-year-old father of three returns to kindergarten, summer camp, the prom, and other embarrassments. The book is published by Little Brown. More about our guest and his book, Do-Over, online at robinhemley.com. And his name is spelled H-E-M-L-E-Y. Settlement prices should now be in from Kansas City and Chicago. Here's Todd Gleason.
Taking a look at those numbers as they finished up in Chicago, it was a very ugly day in the soybean pit, down 87.25 cents in the nearby August contract. The November settled below $10 at $9.81.5. We'll get complete numbers from them in the moment. We'll start with the soft red in Chicago for the winter wheat. September contract up 0.25 cents today, a 486.5 top, bottom at 473.75, and a settlement price there at 481.75, a quarter higher. December wheat, 514.25, the high, the low at 501.25, settlement price at 509.5, up 0.25, and the March contract, 533, the high, the low at 520.75, settled 528.75, up 0.25. May futures in the wheat pit now, 543, the high, the low at 33.25, settlement price at 540.75, up 0.25 cents in July. That's the harvest month for next year. A 555 top, bottom at 542.5, settled 550.75, up a half. From Kansas City, the hard red settled unchanged at 508.5 in its lead option September contract. Corn pit in Chicago, while the beans were down sharply, corn futures modestly lower in the face of an 87-cent drop, I suppose, in beans. September corn at 328 on its high, the low at 318. A settlement price at 319.25, a loss today of 5.25 cents. December contract, 335.5, the high, low at 325.5, settlement price at 327.75, down 4.25. And the March futures, 349.5, the high, the low at $3.39.75, settled 341.5, down 4.5 cents. May futures, 353.25, the high, low at $3.49, settled 350 and three quarters, down 4 3/4 in July contract to 360 and three quarters high, low at 57.5. Settlement price at $3.59, down 4.5 cents. September oats today unchanged, 2.25 the settlement price. December at 2.15 unchanged as well. August soybean futures now $11.75, the high, the low at $11.06. Settlement price $11 even, 87.25 lower for the August soybean futures. September 10.72 the high, low at 10.18 settled $10.24, down 40.75. In November beans, 10.31 the high, the low at 9.78 3/4, settlement price at 9.81 down 37.25. January futures, 10.32 the high, the low at 85.5, settlement price at $9.88, down 36.25. In the March contract, 35 cents lower, 10.32 the high, the low at 9.89, settlement price at 9.88 3/4, down 35 cents. August soybean meal futures, a 3.80 settlement price, down $10.60. August soybean oil at 37.18, finished 36 lower. We'll be back at the 6 after the hour, 2 o'clock time frame, central today, when we'll talk with Mike Zuzulo. He's with Global Analytics out of Lafayette, Indiana. He's our regular Friday guest. Then later in that program, we'll have Bruce Bostard of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company on with us. All happens in just about 9 minutes now. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Let's take a look now at the livestock contracts and how they finished today in Chicago. August live cattle, the high 84.80, the low 83.65, the settlement 84.65, up 47.5. October 88.65, the high 87.65, the low 88.55, the settlement up 35. December 88.27.5, the high 87.40, the low 88.05, the settlement, that up 15. February 88.72.5, the high 87.95, the low, the settlement 88.37.5, down 20. August feeder cattle, the high today $100.70, the low $99.50, the settlement $100.70, up 65. September $100.45, the high $99.40, the low, the settlement $100.20, up 30. October $100.65, the high $99.22.5, the low, the settlement $100.27.5, that up 20. November $101.10, the high, the low $100, the settlement $100.92.5, that up 22.5. August lean hogs $49.20, the high $49.00, the low $49.12.5, the settlement, that up 32.5. October $45.15, the high $44.60, the low $44.65, the settlement down 75. December $45.10, the high $44.55, the low, the settlement $44.82.5, down 22.5. February $53.65, the high $53.15, the low, the settlement $53.27.5, down 47.5. August bellies $40.00, the high $38.50, the low, the settlement $40.00, that down 50 cents. The Dow is currently off 131 points at 9267. The NASDAQ is off 36 at 1973. The S&P 500 off 14 points at 998. Nearby crude oil down 311 a barrel at 67.41. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our technical director today is Henry Frayne. Let's take a look at the forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon. Mostly sunny, highs between 84 and 90. Tonight, mostly clear, lows ranging between 59 in northeastern Indiana to 68 in the Chicago area. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs ranging from 87 to 92.